I don't know about you, but I love the amps. No better way to start the Five Quadrants of Portland today. You are listening to the Five Quadrants of Portland. I'm John Sepulveda.
And I'm Jen Chavez.
And today we are going to be talking about Oregon ballot initiatives. This is part of our coverage of elections right here on KXRY Portland as we go through. We're going to go right to it now. We have Dennis Thoralt of the Portland Mercury. He runs Hall Pass, the column. Dennis, are you there?
I'm here. Hey, John. How are you?
Hey, Dennis. All right, Dennis, the first thing we want to talk about is we want to get right into it because we have an hour packed for what's going on. I want to talk about the GMO ballot initiative because that one is when I seem to watch TV during news or when I was watching during the World Series, for example, I saw a lot of ads. And no matter what happened, I seemed to see one farmer say one thing that we need GMO labeling to protect their farms, their crops. And then I'll see another farmer say that this is unfair, that the pro-GMO campaign of labeling GMO of foods is essentially not telling the truth. The Mercury came out with an endorsement. I want you to tell us a little bit about this initiative and tell us why you came to the decision y'all did on this endorsement.
So we said no to this, and the issue is labeling genetically engineered food products, and this initiative would put a label that said produced with genetically engineered food at the bottom of a piece of food, or you know, not every piece of food wouldn't apply to alcohol. It wouldn't apply to food you get at a cafeteria, but it would be a lot of food. And there's a lot of people from companies like Monsanto, DuPont, Coca-Cola, Sunny Delight. We found out all giving
Sunny
money
Delight.
To
you're talking about
this initiative.
You're Sunny Delight, the fake orange juice company.
The fake orange juice company. So yeah. a lot of big money gets this, and that's a really uncomfortable thing. But where we came down is we said this is still not a great initiative. We don't think this works. We think this the label doesn't mean as much as it could mean. It doesn't say anything about whether the food is harmful or not. It just says it has genetically engineered food inside of this. And you know, if you're trying to talk about changing agricultural practices, if you want to sort of, you don't like the idea that food is being made pesticide resistant, if you're worried that's going to increase the use of pesticides someday because, you know, we have to use more and more to, you know, as people adapt around that resistance, you know, that's a thing, and we get that, and we don't like anything that you know, Monsanto and other people like, but we couldn't go for this. It was a tepid no, but we just came down on the wrong side, and our hope is that another label might come out that says, you know, made with, you know, herbicide-resistant grain or pesticide-resistant grain. That would be something that tells me something about what I was choosing versus something that, you know, says it's there. There are GMOs in this food. You know, is it a bad GMO? Is it going to hurt me? Is it killing me? Is it poisoning me? I don't think that's the case. The science is nearly certain that it's not bad for us, and obviously we should still study this, but I think we're creating some panic about something that we haven't fully studied, and we can have better information if we do want to make choice.
You know, recently there has been a lot, especially in Europe, about the labeling of genetically modified crops and foods. We've seen other states take up this cause. Isn't part of the deal here just to let consumers know? So, for example, if enough states or even enough foreign countries begin to kind of create this critical mass of labeling the food so that consumers can make their own decisions, that eventually it'll just become industry-wide because it'll be too expensive to have a label just for Oregon or a label just for California or a label just for France or Ireland or England. Isn't that part of the overall cause, not just to protect or let Oregon consumers know about it, but to create this kind of critical mass to change the industry nationally and internationally?
I think that's great if we want to talk about changing the industry nationally. And you're right. There is, I think, some hope that, you know, a few states getting behind a labeling initiative will create that critical mass. We've seen that with greenhouse gas emissions in cars. I mean, California paved the way for federal standards doing that. It's not an inconsequential argument, but, you know, I think we still need to run the risk of sort of making sure we have information that's valuable for us, that we know what we're talking about, we know what we're getting. You know, a bad labeling initiative is not going to help anything. There are other GMOs that are not involved in bad agriculture, and Why should we get in the way of those foods? Why should we work against an industry that is actually helping, in some respects, deal with hunger, deal with blight? You know, bad agricultural practices are one thing. The GMOs themselves are part of that, but they are not itself the bad thing.
Hmm.
Dennis, I have a question about an argument I've heard used a lot by opponents of this measure, and that is that it will raise the cost of food. And I've even seen people saying that that will disproportionately affect low-income people. What's your response to that argument? Is that something you'd agree with? Would the potential rise of food cost be substantial?
I don't think so. We actually didn't think the cost was going to matter for us. And we thought about that. We heard both sides. We sat down with the two campaigns in the same room and were fairly persuaded by the yes side that this wouldn't make things expensive. It might raise costs a little bit, but I think it's easily absorbed. If these companies can spend millions of dollars to fight against the measure, they could certainly afford a labeling regime. And certainly if that goes national, it's going to be even cheaper. I don't, you know, there is that $14 million figure that the no side is trotting out from the state. It's been discredited, and I think people need to know that. It's not going to, you know, we're not going to take money out of people's pockets, but I think the other issues are still bigger than that. I would love a label that had more context.
You said, not you personally, but the Mercury editorial said, quote, "The essential problem is dishonesty." You're talking about Measure 92's proponents. You say, "Measure 92's proponents argue it's all about helping consumers make an informed choice. They insisted in our interview that they have no problem with GMOs and no other motives, ulterior or not, besides the spread of information." The editorial went on to disagree with us. Tell us why you came to this conclusion, what was said in the interview, and why you decided to relay this information to the public.
We asked repeatedly, what else is this leading to? Is this about changing agricultural practices? Is this what your goal is by promoting this measure? And they said repeatedly, no, this is about choice. I think it was maybe two or three times we came to that point. And they said, no, this is about choice. And that's fine. I don't agree with that. And I know not everyone in the movement would say that, but that's what the campaign said. So we felt that that was not a credible answer, and we wish they would have said something more about what they were actually trying to do.
Hmm. You also said that this campaign is identical to the efforts that narrowly failed in California. I actually happened to be in California for that campaign. And Washington, do we have any idea nationally, as we talk about trying to create this critical mass for this type of labeling, do we have any idea why they chose Oregon? Did they talk a little bit about this? Because it seems that when I'm looking at the spending from both these groups, it's coming from outside of the state. Did you get a chance to talk about that during your editorial process?
We didn't talk about that. I do have some thoughts about why that might be the case, though. We're a significant state on food. I think people look to Oregon as a leader in food opinion, in food policy. But I also think we're a purple state to some degree. If we can win here, if they can get a victory in a state like Oregon, where you're having most of the state overcoming a very democratic large city at its northern fringe, you can make a case for other states in this case.
I see what you're saying.
I think we would have seen that with the same-sex marriage fight this year if that had happened.
And we'll talk about I want to talk about the things that didn't actually make the ballot in just a bit. And I know, Jen, you got a question.
Yeah. I wanted to ask another thing just about the editorial process and coming to this decision. You write, or the editorial team writes, yet after much debate, we're coming down just on the no side of this issue. Does that refer to a debate with amongst the Mercury team? Was it a difficult decision to come to with the other folks who you were working with?
It was a very difficult decision. Certainly, we struggled with the right thing to do here, and we came down on the no side for the issues we talked about. And it was we had to work among ourselves to make sure that's how we all felt. It was a consensus decision here, and that's important to note. But we also figured that if people didn't agree with us, if they still voted yes, if this does happen, I don't think the sky is going to fall either. And I think we wanted to convey we didn't want to convey a false sense of alarm if the yes side won. I don't think bad things are going to happen. We're in charge of making decisions as we see them and how we see them, and we do our best. And we make the decision we make, and not everyone's going to agree with it. A lot of people, I think, were rather disappointed that we didn't say yes when all the other newspapers in town also said no.
Have you gotten the outlier. Have you gotten backlash to that? I was wondering, because I recall when you guys a couple years ago endorsed fluoridation of the water supply, that the mercury faced quite a backlash from opponents of that. What's the response been to this choice from your readers?
It's been a lot of the same. People say they're not going to read us anymore. But of course, they said that after the fluoride debacle, sure, which I think remains one of our finer stories. I'm really proud of the cover story we did on fluoridation. And people said they weren't going to read us. And of course, we didn't ever see those numbers materialize. People we have the same readership we've always had. It's actually a little bit bigger, so we've grown. So I don't know that this is going to matter, but I think people maybe expect this from the Oregonian. They expected this from the Tribune. They probably also expected it from Willamette Week, and so there was talk of a flash mob protest. They couldn't get the right people to do that to come to our office. That was aborted, but there was a talk of that, and KBOO wanted to talk about us, and they said it was about all the other papers, but it was really about us, and we're the lightning rod for this, and that's fair. I get it. I'm kind of honored that people have that expectation in some respects, and, you know, independence goes both ways.
You know,
that's the way I see it.
You know, Dennis, I was going to say that, I know I'm new to Portland. I don't want to talk about myself, but I've been a journalist for a long time, and I do have to respect the fact that y'all approach this from an independent, regardless of how it might upset potential readership and such. That's rare. We often see media outlets will kind of parrot what their audience or their readership might want. And I do think on that one particular guard, I would vote for the Mercury on that particular instance. I'm very appreciative
Thank
of that.
You. Thank you.
Speaking of voting, besides the fact that this is an election, I want to turn now to Measure 90, which is the top two primary system that is being put before voters. Just very briefly, Dennis, tell us what this initiative is and how it would work.
So this would do away with our current election system by putting every candidate from any party on a primary ballot, and then the top two candidates, regardless of party, would advance to the fall election. And there's some other wrinkles in there, but that's the gist. And it would, you know, this is billed as a way to increase turnout in the primary, activate all, you know, the nearly 700,000 Oregonians who don't register with a political party of any kind, or who also register with a minor party. I don't see that as necessarily coming true here. We have some issues with the way this is going to work. They have this in California and Washington. It's not achieved some of those stated goals in those states.
Go ahead. Oh, Jen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was reading, as part of your endorsement, you mentioned particularly interesting situation that happened in California. You said there's been weirdness, like the heavily Democratic congressional district in California won by a Republican in 2012 after all four Democrats who ran in the primary so diluted the vote that none of them made the cut. So is how this is working in other states kind of supporting your stance on this? And tell me more about that weirdness, I suppose.
That happened in 2012, but it almost happened again this year. I think it was maybe a few tenths of a percentage point away from happening again. You know, not having a Democrat on the general election ballot with a Republican. So that, you know, the supporters of this campaign said, well, that's going to work itself out. It really almost hasn't worked itself out. And that's one of the more egregious cases. I think the bigger impact is that there hasn't been much of an impact in the way that they were hoping. And in Oregon, because we don't have what California has, California actually pretty heavily restricts campaign donations.
They don't restrict
them at all.
And they have great transparency laws about...
That's right.
Yeah. So continue. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, but I think those are important to note, that when you talk about the differences and why it might not be having as bad of an effect in California, maybe it's just having a moderate to no effect on anything. The bad is magnified in Oregon because we don't limit campaign spending, and we can see business groups who have deeper pockets spending a lot of money in a primary, spending a lot of money again in a general election after doing some gamesmanship. And you know, as Common Cause Oregon pointed out in some really good reports, everyone should go to Common Cause Oregon, read their analysis of this measure, and they found out that the left side of the political spectrum in California has moderated more than the right side. I think the middle is already too far to the right in this country, and we need to move it to the left. So, you know, maybe I'm a bit partisan in this also.
No, well, that's a good point. I mean, as folks are listening to this broadcast, perhaps that's something, you know, I've heard a lot of people complain just about the partisan nature in general. And one of the things I do know, as you know, Dennis, and let our listeners know, I came from California. One of the things that people in California liked about this was the fact that it really forced folks to talk about issues and ideas as opposed to party affiliation. It wasn't good enough just to say that you're the Democrat in the race. You actually had to distinguish how your type of stances on Democratic issue or on Democrat issues are different than perhaps somebody else. And it, also in that kind of weird example you give, I'd also like to say, you know, elections are weird sometimes. I mean, we saw Eric Cantor voted out. Nobody was expecting that. Those types of things happen from time to time. Is it enough just to say, well, let me ask you this. Was this approached from a partisan point of view in this particular endorsement that you saw diluting the power of the left in Oregon?
I think that was a part of what we weighed. You have to look at what the effect of this is going to be on the kind of state we want Oregon to become. What kinds of policies do we want to emerge from our legislature? Do we want mandatory sick leave statewide? Do we want an increased minimum wage? We talked about this in our endorsement of Governor Kitzhaber also. Mm. These are the big things that Oregon has to contend with, and I'm afraid that the middle is going to involve too many compromises on taxes, on revenues, and not enough on the things that workers in this state need to thrive and have a good life.
Hmm. One last question on this. I have not looked at the polling particularly. Are we seeing any idea where the polling is on this idea of a nonpartisan or top two primary system?
Last I recalled, it was not doing well. Not doing as poorly as the driver card measure, and you know, doing maybe a little bit worse than the marijuana measure. So it's a tough sell. It's a hard argument for people in the state. And we voted on this in 2008 as Oregonians and also said no. This is it's a little bit changed since then, but not nearly enough, I think, to persuade voters.
And I was really surprised on, let's switch now to the marijuana initiative. I was really surprised to see that y'all came out saying no. I'm joking. You guys totally said yes.
Sean, you're going to give us a heart attack.
let's talk a little bit about why the Mercury endorsed legalized marijuana here in the state of Oregon.
It just makes sense. It's time. It's time to do this everywhere in this country. It's not worked. And you know, you can look at the cost of jailing people, what it does to your record, even in a decriminalized state. That's unconscionable. But then you can look at racial issues. We have, you know, African-Americans and whites in Oregon who are using marijuana at the same rate, and yet African-Americans are twice as likely to be jailed, punished, arrested, in prison for this. That's not okay. And you know, it's not sane. I don't know. We supported the last measure 2 years ago, which wasn't as well written as this one, and it was a pretty earnest endorsement for that. And when we said no to an expansion of medicinal marijuana in 2010, it was because we actually just wanted a outright legalization. So we're very ardent supporters of this issue. It didn't even have to be a pot smoker to think this is good for us. It's just smart. I just don't understand why this is not penetrating. There's so many other intoxicants that we're fine with and that we regulate and that people enjoy responsibly. Marijuana can be one of them, and frankly, for a lot of people, it is one of them.
You know, I just to play devil's advocate for a second, one of the things that I've seen in other states is that if, along with the legalization push, and I will say California, for example, actually has decriminalized marijuana, which in for certain amounts in effect has made it legal. But in Colorado, Washington, those are two different states and they've handled it two different ways. And one of the more successful ways we've actually seen in some parts of near Seattle is that in order for it to work, the black market has to be stamped out. That's not my analysis. That's from the RAND Corporation. I'm curious, what if supporting this means that in order for it to work in Oregon, that you actually have to increase police presence. You actually have to crack down even harder on illegal marijuana sales in order for it to work, as many experts have suggested. I imagine that could give progressives some cause as well, or some pause, I should say.
I think that could be an issue, but we've been trying that for 40 years. Hmm. We've learned that the more money and resources we throw at law enforcement has not decreased the rates of use, the rates of anything. It's actually just cost us more money down the line. This is a market-based approach to the black market. If people don't want to have to buy pot from bad people, and actually I think in Oregon right now you're not buying pot from bad people. You're getting it on the medical market right now. That's been the great thing about medical marijuana, is it's gotten patients help that they need, but it's also softly showed people that there are other ways. You don't need to get it from a cartel-packed brick of bad pot anymore. You can get a nice neighbor who's growing a very good, pleasant strain in their basement or backyard now, and that's going to continue here. You can go to the store and buy it.
Well, I want to live in your neighborhood.
I think the money is going to be an issue. Yeah.
No, well, I was just saying this idea that it could be grown, but the other thing too is we saw in California, you know, the U.S. Department of Justice has signaled yet again that, you know, depending on the size and scope, they are still willing to crack down. We saw in 2010 that killed the legalization effort in California, up until the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder had said that they would crack down. You know, we saw the polls were showing great support for legalizing marijuana. After his announcement, they went down dramatically. Is that, based on your reading of it, the U.S. Department of Justice's consistent mixed messages about legalization of marijuana and medical marijuana and marijuana vendors? Do you think that that's playing at all in this, or is it just that people don't like it? What is the reason for the bad poll numbers?
I think that might be because people don't like it. I think people think of the Bradley effect when you know, 30 years ago, and you know, people were asked if they would vote for an African American candidate, and they said yes to a pollster, but actually voted no. They didn't want the stigma of being seen as racist, so they said no. Privately, but yes, when publicly asked, it might be that with marijuana we're seeing a similar effect, that people are still a little bit, you know, well, it's kind of illegal and it's not that good, and you know, they're going to say no in a poll, but then actually vote yes. That's what I'm hoping for. I think the federal issue still weighs on people, but that's so changeable. It's not set in stone. Marijuana is regulated with some awful narcotics, and it really shouldn't be. It's far more benign, again, than some products that we allow for legal sale at grocery stores and convenience stores. Mm.
You know, on that point, I was kind of curious. The opponents to this measure statewide, you know, not just the federal government, but also local and regional law enforcement is opposed to this, presumably because they think that marijuana is a more dangerous narcotic, as it's being painted as. But are they going farther to kind of defend the so-called drug war and enforcement of this? You say, you know, we've been doing this for 40 years and it's not working. Are they acknowledging that the system is flawed, or are they arguing that no, what we're doing now is the best way to enforce these laws and to try to lower drug use?
I think that's sort of what they're saying, is mm-hmm. that this, you know, well, it's not so bad. People can, you know, nobody really gets in trouble, is what the Clatsop County Attorney Josh Markey, one of the very vocal proponents of the no campaign on pot, told us. It's like, it's not that big of a deal already. Like, you know, they kind of like having a system where when they need to, they can use marijuana as pretext to go after someone who's committing a crime. They like having that ability, but they realize that for most people it's not a problem. The problem is we've seen what happens when law enforcement exercises that kind of discretion. It actually ends up not being exercised in a fair manner.
Dennis, I want to finally end, and we have so much we wanted to cover with you, but we're almost out of time. Finally, you told me this really interesting story. You said that if one particular voter initiative passes here in Oregon, you plan on yourself going and acquiring a driving card. Tell us about the initiative. Tell us about why you yourself would do it.
So this is a bill that was signed by the governor last year, that if you can't prove your immigration status, you can still prove that you're a good driver. You get to take a driving test, show that you can handle a car, then you can go get insurance and be a legal licensed driver. Or not regulated driver, I should say. Of course, a few Oregonians thought this was a terrible idea, that you're going to embolden illegal immigration. You know, we're just going to be a flood of mayhem coming to the state. And they referred it to the ballot, and it's losing badly. I think that's a shame. And I would get one of these. I don't think that driving privileges ought to be tied to your ID card. I don't see why those two have to be connected. It's a marriage of convenience, frankly. And I would happily go get one of these cards so people who are undocumented, who might be afraid of a stigma if this were to pass, wouldn't have to worry. It wouldn't be just undocumented immigrants getting this card. It could be for anybody. And that's sort of a statement of solidarity that I would offer. And you know, I think it kind of makes, I love it, actually. They just get an ID card and not have a driver's license, have a driver card. It would be, you know, it's kind of a sensible thing. And I would actually encourage anyone I knew to do that, but I don't think we're going to have that choice, actually, because it's not looking good.
You know, and what's crazy about this to me is here in Portland, we have seen almost every single civic and editorial institution come out in favor of this, because besides the fact, and this is my opinion, besides the fact that it makes sense for insurance carriers and insurance providers, and it obviously has shown a clear correlation in other states with making roadways safer, it seems to be failing statewide. How much of this is racial?
I hesitate to say that. I think most of it is actually aimed that way. And people have been offended that we pointed that out in our editorial endorsement of this measure. People were, you know, sad that we did that. I think it's true. And I think there is a latent racism in this. And that's a shame. And that's going to take a lot more time to change. It does make sense, though. And it really, people need to be able to take their kids to the doctor, to school, and get insured and be, you know, it can work. It just, people are here working and living amongst, these are our neighbors. We should treat them accordingly.
You know, I'm going to agree with you. I think most of it's racial, especially some of the campaign literature I've seen. It's not overtly racial, but there's definitely an undertow that seems really ugly and unbefitting of a country. And this is my opinion in 2014, the idea that this is still existing. If there wants to be economic arguments made about it or safety arguments, all about having that discussion, but there definitely seems to be an undertow of racism with regards to that campaign. Dennis Arault, we are out of time. I want to say thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for being on again, Dennis.
As always, I always enjoy it.
And we'll be talking more and including about the Measure 88 in just a moment. You are listening to the Five Quadrants of Portland. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Thank you.
I'm okay, Tom York. Anyways, you are listening to the Five Quadrants of Portland. You're just listening to a little bit of Radiohead as we get our new next guest. But first, I'm John Sepulveda.
And I'm Jen Chavez. So, you know, we've been talking about ballot measures today because Election Day is coming up soon on November 4th. Hope you all got your ballots. But you know, as you know, perhaps if you've been listening for a while, one of the focuses of the this little show we've got going here is to think about how civic issues affect underrepresented communities. And that includes many different kinds of cultural communities, but one community that I find important to think about are low-income people in Portland.
Absolutely.
People experiencing poverty and even homelessness. So I brought on our next guest because I wanted to talk about how these ballot measures might specifically affect people experiencing poverty or affect them more so than others. I am pleased to introduce the Israel Bayer of Street Roots. He's the executive director of Street Roots, which is Portland's flagship publication addressing homelessness and poverty. They provide employment opportunities for Street Roots vendors. Israel, thank you so much for joining us once more on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we were just talking with Dennis Theralt from the Mercury about Measure 88 a little bit before we went to the break. And so I'd like to start there with you. That, as we heard, would make driver's cards available to those lacking proof of legal residence. One of our guests last week, journalist and Filipino immigrant Jose Antonio Vargas, reminded us with his story that the debate around driver's cards is not just a Latino issue, but Street Roots' endorsement of the measure reminds us that it's not just an immigration issue either. Street Roots writes, quote, "Not to mention it goes a long way in supporting people in experiencing poverty to have the necessary identification to access a home," end quote. Now, this is a driver's card measure, not a wider ID measure, so this wouldn't benefit everybody, but who in particular of those experiencing poverty would this measure apply to and benefit if passed?
Well, unfortunately, we have a lot of Oregonians that are experiencing homelessness that sleep in their vehicles, so whether that be a car or an RV or something of that nature. So when you think about being able to access a driver's card, it's really important to be able to be legal so that you can maintain, to be able to maintain your housing in a vehicle, as sad as that might be.
Israel, one of the things that we've heard from some of the folks that are opposed to this, to 88, is that this would somehow allow for legal status. There's this kind of shadow argument that this is a pathway to citizenship. In your reading of this ballot initiative, do you see anything that would suggest that?
No, I think that this is a common sense, you know, approach to be able to, from a safety perspective. The reality is that people that are needing to access the driver's card are our neighbors and our friends and ultimately the people working throughout Oregon to be able to deliver all kinds of things ranging from, you know, agriculture to the environment to any kind of basic services. So when you think about this measure, I don't think it has anything to do with legal citizenship so much as it does to be able to keep all Oregonians safe and to be able to allow people that are working people to be able to continue to work and be productive members of our community.
You're just talking about all Oregonians, and the truth is, you just pointed out, is that some Oregonians unfortunately are sleeping in their cars. I want you to kind of dig a little bit deeper and bring us the personal side of who this is going to impact. Do you have a personal anecdote or a story of somebody who is sleeping in their car and not having this proper driving documentation has hurt them?
Well, yeah, I mean, over the years, as we've covered a range of different issues, and especially people living in their cars, when you think about not being able to have a driver's card, you're in a situation where if you don't have proper identification and you lose access to your car. So it may be, we are aware of individuals that are sleeping in their car that would be affected by this, and it's not only the livelihood of potentially one person, but it could be the livelihood of many people that are caught in that unfortunate circumstance.
You know, as has been mentioned, obviously many extremely low-income people don't drive or have a car, and they'll continue to face barriers to having the valuable tool of proper identification. But are you hoping that this measure, if passed or even if not, at least starts a conversation around further sort of policy change? And if so, what might that conversation ideally look like to you?
Well, I think that this measure could pave the way to be able to have a larger discussion about how we access identification for all Oregonians. You know, the unfortunate reality is when you don't have an identification, then you are put at a disadvantage when you're talking about accessing things like housing and employment, which are vital needs that people have to be able to get out of poverty. So we're hoping that this measure paves the way to be able to really have a larger conversation about how people experiencing homelessness can access an official identification to be able to actually give them the opportunity to get on their feet and to become housed, and it to not be a barrier or a challenge when thinking about becoming productive members of society.
Israel Bear with Street Roots, we just spoke with Dennis Ralt of the Portland Mercury, and we asked him this question. I'm curious what your perspective on this is. How much of the opposition to 88 has to do with race?
Well, I mean, I think it's a big racial, I mean, at the heart of all of this, I think that there is, this is about racial justice, and I think that the reality is that a lot of the immigrants and refugees and people that need to access driver's cards are brown people, and that the reality is that race is at the heart of so many of these discussions. And I think in order to be a just society where we're not discriminating against anybody, that this is just a common sense approach to be able to keep our roads safe and to be able to keep people, again, having the opportunity to better their lives.
Well, we are talking about ballot initiatives right here on the Five Quadrants of Portland. We want to now talk about another ballot initiative that could further impact race or criminal justice. I forgot how to talk for a second there, Israel. I'm really sorry about that. Blah, blah, blah. We're talking about now Measure 91. What is your view? What is Street Roots' view on Measure 91, which would legalize marijuana in the state?
Yeah, Street Roots has long advocated for the decriminalization of marijuana, and more so what this measure does is the legalization of marijuana. You know, I think we're going on multiple decades of a failed drug war. We know that, unfortunately, that the way that the criminal justice system works, that it unfairly targets people experiencing poverty. And, you know, we also believe in a very we believe that marijuana is a medicinal herb, and that people should not only from a medical standpoint but from a recreational standpoint be allowed to access marijuana. And we're just thrilled that we have the chance here in Oregon to be able to pass this.
Israel, you know, as you say, the opinion that the drug war has failed has become pretty mainstream. It's often cited and pretty well documented, for one, that drug prohibition has disproportionately affected people of color. And you mentioned that it's also disproportionately affected and targeted people experiencing poverty and homelessness. How have you seen that play out with low-income people, regardless of their race?
Well, I think low-income people and people of color, obviously the statistics show that there's a higher rate of being targeted by law enforcement. And I think that when the conversation comes into place around the issue of marijuana, you have a higher likelihood for being caught with marijuana when you're poor or you're a person of color, because simply you're being targeted or pulled over more by law enforcement. And, you know, I think it plays out in a very practical sense when you have poor people, you know, doing the same things as any other part of society that are just unfairly targeted. So,
these things are. well, rather hold on just as much.
Yeah, I don't, you know, pardon us, Israel, there's some kind of silly sauce going on in the studio where we just can't talk today. You know, as we talk about legalized marijuana, one of the things that we were talking about Dennis Thrault with the Portland Mercury is that there has been some, on the flip of it, there have been significant studies and policy pieces by RAND, by UCLA, by some others that have showed in order for legalized marijuana to ultimately work and take hold, there actually has to be an even harsher crackdown by police on the illegal black market up front. And some of the projections go, you know, for example, with RAND, it goes from 1 to 4 years. A policy paper done by UCLA showed 2 years. If that's the cost, where we could actually see even more people swept up in this crackdown in order to make legalized marijuana work over the long term, would that still be something that you support?
Well, you know, I think that we're at an experimental phase, and I don't think, you know, while the study, there's all kinds of studies that show all kinds of different varying viewpoints on this issue, I think from a practical standpoint, we're just at the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, I think that the city of Portland specifically is looking very closely at how King County and Denver deal with the legalization of marijuana. You know, I mean, from our perspective, you know, the sex trade, the drug trade, some illegal things happening on the black market are very real. And by legalizing marijuana, it frees up law enforcement's ability to be able to track some of the more intense things that are plaguing our community. So, you know, I think that we are in we don't know how exactly things are going to be affected as it relates to the black market. What we do know is that there is a large, you know, organized crime and other things control a lot of the flow of marijuana in our community and throughout the United States. And this this allows, you know, the states and local communities to be able to kind of take that back and do it in a way that's regulated, in a way that's positive for our community. You know, the revenue that's going to be created for the state is not something to just overlook, understanding that 25% of the revenue created will go to drug treatment, and school funding will be at 40%, and then state and local police at 35%. Those are all very real revenue streams that are going to help local communities.
And, you know, I wanted to bring up an interesting article that I read recently in Street Roots. You know, Measure 91 is forecast to be an extremely close race. Polling by the Oregonian and KGW this weekend showed opposition gaining and taking a slight lead. But in the Street Roots piece I mentioned by Jake Thomas, it's noted that even the passage of Measure 91 might not alleviate disproportionate effects of federal drug laws on low-income people. For example, there's an issue with federally subsidized housing prohibiting marijuana use, sometimes even medical, if I'm not mistaken. What's the story there?
Well, when you're talking about federally subsidized housing, so any nonprofit or organization that is providing housing that is federally funded are subsidized to support people experiencing homelessness, coming out of homelessness, and getting back on their feet would be under the same scrutiny of federal law. So, you know, in the context of being able to, you know, access marijuana and smoke it in your own home, people that are do have federal subsidized housing would be under federal rules, and they would not be able to access marijuana in the same way that the general public might be.
Israel, I got to ask, you know, one of the arguments we hear against marijuana is, well, actually, there are two major arguments I consistently hear. One is that corporations are going to take it over, so we're going to have the R.J. Reynolds of pot, whether it's with the Bacardi family or whether it is with R.J. Reynolds or another group. Let's start with that. Do you have any concern about the corporatization of marijuana here in Oregon if it passes?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that Street Roots has been talking to local foundations and government about is how do we engage people, specifically poor people, that may already be selling weed or marijuana on the black market in a way where we're able to create job opportunities for people that are poor. And so I think anytime you legalize something like marijuana, it's going to bring venture capitalists from all over the place to be able to make a profit off of the legalization, but I think at the same time that, you know, we live in a place that is very opportunistic, very entrepreneurial in spirit. I think it's a perfect time to think about how do you create jobs, how do you access different populations to be able to benefit off of legalization of marijuana in a very regulated and mainstream way. And so, you know, I'm encouraging foundations and other people to think about what it means to, you know, investigate and research and figure out, do we need nonprofits or other groups to specifically work on those issues that we're talking about.
And Israel Bear of Street Roots, last question on this particular issue. I hear often that it'll start with marijuana, next thing will be heroin, next thing will be cocaine, next thing will be methamphetamine. What do you say to that slippery slope argument? And isn't there possibly some credence in that if this works, perhaps we will change our understanding of drug addiction and the way we enforce drug laws?
Well, I mean, Street Roots believes in a harm reduction approach when it comes to all kinds of drugs. But in this case, I mean, I think to point out marijuana as being a gateway drug is completely unfounded and ridiculous when we live in a society that, you know, most of the drug intake in our communities happen through pharmaceutical companies and through over-the-counter drugs that are peddled through large corporations to begin with. So when you have a conversation about gateway drugs, it can't just start with drugs on the illegal market. It has to be a broader conversation. And in my mind, until that conversation takes place in a more accurate and healthy way, I don't think that you can point to marijuana over anything else as being a cause for any kind of further drug use in an individual's life.
Israel Bear of Street Roots, we're talking today on the Five Quadrants of Portland about Oregon's ballot initiatives that are going before voters. We want to remind everybody, Jen Chavez, don't we? Go out and vote.
Oh, please do.
Don't
please.
A dope. Go vote. That's my new slogan. Israel, we were talking about the corporatization of you know, drug use or potential drug use if the marijuana initiative passes. We were talking about pharmaceutical companies being more of a gateway drug. And that's going to lead me to another area which seems to be a huge corporate battle right now, which is Measure 92.
Yeah, you and the Street Roots editorial team support Measure 92, calling it a no-brainer, but other media outlets have not been agreeing with you on that. As we heard earlier, the Mercury endorsed a no vote. The Willamette Week also did, as did the Oregonian back in August. In some places, opposition of the bill is being tied to issues of poverty, which I found interesting. The Oregonian writes, quote, "Mandatory labeling almost certainly will raise food costs as well, which will have a disproportionate effect upon those with the least money to spend." Supporters of the measure naturally dismiss the pocketbook argument. We were just speaking with Dennis, and he's dismissed it to a degree as well. But you know, from where you're sitting as the head of Street Roots, which
focuses
delves
on
into
underserved
issues,
communities.
Yeah, of poverty.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that argument, that poverty argument by the no campaign?
Well, I think that the idea that poor people shouldn't or don't want to have access to understand what is in their food, or in this case, to be able to support the idea of, you know, labeling of genetically modified foods is completely ridiculous. I think that,
you know, Israel, is that really what the issue is, or is it the fact that poor people can't generally afford these
poor people can't afford food to begin with. Why draw the line in the sand here?
But
our argument is not about the system around food equity. And access to food is so complex, and the idea that this would be, you know, the thing that would drive food cost up when you have all these different varying degrees and very complex systems in place where people aren't able to access food to begin with, again, in our mind, is ridiculous. And so, you know, Street Roots vendors, I always find it ironic, you know, I would say that Street Roots vendors, more than not, are accessing food with the hard-earned money. They want to buy organic food. They want to be able to access food at farmers markets and use their money smartly to shop at a place like New Seasons over somewhere else. And so, you know, the idea that this is going to drive up food costs, maybe it will, but that two wrongs don't make a right. And you can't create, you can't, we just don't believe that you could draw the line in the sand over genetically modified foods and the fact that corporations are going to have to drive up cost of food based upon this. The level of greed, the level of cost gouging, the level of everything that is kind of in the mix when it means higher food costs for people have nothing to do with GMO labeling. It has to do with a much larger kind of broken system. So we just don't believe it should be drawn in the line, the sand in the line with this issue. And yeah, it's okay. Just that simple.
Well, Israel, let me ask you this. You said you were talking about street vendors. We do know, for example, that more people with SNAP and EBT benefits are actually trying to purchase and have access to organic foods, even though it comes at a higher percentage of their benefits. What is the diet like for a street roots vendor? And for folks that might not know, tell us a little bit about the street roots vendors so we can have a better understanding of how you came to this decision.
You know, I think that the vast amount of food that's accessible for people on the streets has improved over the course of the last two decades. I do believe that there's still a lot of unhealthy foods that people are accessing, sometimes even through food banks, but obviously with just a limited amount of resources that they have. But when you think about homelessness specifically, we've got a whole range of different groups working on food equity issues that are providing really great meals at a lot of different places throughout the community. So Sisters of the Road, Blanchet House, et cetera, et cetera. So they're serving quality meals, working and partnering with a lot of organizations and local groups to be able to deliver, you know, farm-raised food for people experiencing poverty. I think, you know, street roots vendors specifically are using their money to be able to access a variety of different food options. So it's hard to really speak for any one specific population amongst the group. But what we do know is that when the vendors are able to, we know that we have vendors shopping at People's Food Cooperative or at New Seasons or at Whole Foods. And, you know, that's a sign to us that they're willing to even pay more for quality food because they understand the complexities of, you know, the food system in ways just like every other person in society does. So, again, it's not only going to hurt poor people, the idea of the raising costs, but it'll hurt, it could potentially hurt all people, but we just don't believe. We believe that that's a paper tiger. So.
All right. Well, Israel Baer from Street Roots, I really appreciate your response and your thoughts today. Thank you so much for joining us and for telling us a little bit more about your vendors and your editorial process. Thank you very much for being on the show today, Israel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Israel. And you are listening to the Five Quadrants of Portland. I'm John Sepulveda.
And I'm Jen Chavez. I wanted to quickly remind you, of course, that November 4th is Election Day. As we've telling you, vote, vote, vote.
Don't be a dope. Go vote.
There's one more thing that's also happening on November 4th that I wanted to make sure people knew about. Portland's Planning and Sustainability Commission will host its last public hearing on the draft comprehensive plan on that day. People are invited to testify on the goals, policies, and maps of the sweeping and recently updated land use plan for the city. The hearing runs from 4 to 8 in the Bureau's building at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue. Details can be found at portlandoregon.gov/BPS.
That's right. And before you go there, vote. I don't want to hear any of this nonsense
about
voting doesn't matter.
And then at 4, make it down to the Planning and Sustainability building to be a part of city process.
For the love of love, take part in your democracy. Anyways, or your Democratic Republic, save the emails. I know what kind of form of government we have. we also want to remind that you have a chance right now to vote for X-Ray FM. We are in our membership drive. We are going until noon on Monday. If you love the programming that you're hearing, if you like the program that you're hearing, which you are doing because you are listening, Jen, and I will tell this, you are listening because of one of two things. One, your radio's broken and you can't move it. Or two, you're waiting for the next great programming to come, which is going to be 5 useless degrees and a bottle of scotch, the best theatrical program in the world, theatrical review program. We want you to become a member. 503-963-4250. During this hour, anybody who becomes a member, their membership will be matched dollar for dollar, so they get to vote twice.
Woo.
Vote twice for X-Ray and then
so
go.
So you can vote three times in the next week or so if you feel like it.
Yeah, exactly. Vote three times. Do it. Show some support. 503-963-4250. Or what's another way they can do it, Jen?
Well, they can go right on over to the World Wide Web. Go to xray.fm. You'll see our lovely play button and right next to it, a lovely Become a Member Today button.
That's right.
My show is, of course, not the only wonderful programming on the station. 5 Useless Degrees, Bitch Media's Propaganda Podcast is
Sarah
another
Merck,
one of
Paula,
my favorites.
Sarah Merck.
What's up, Sarah? And then Jefferson Smith, you got Carl Wolfson, all the pals.
Tom Hartman.
If you like what you're hearing, imagine what we can do with your support.
That's right. We can do so much. 7 months, Helen Kennedy, who was in here about an hour ago, she's a board member here at X-Ray Gen. She was calling us the baby radio station. And I was thinking, if this is baby, to go from 7 months to nothing to operating and having an even improved signal and all this stuff. If this is baby, this is like the biggest baby in the world. I feel sorry for the mother that has to birth this radio station. It is huge. You can help make it huger. We want to blow it up like a radioactive Chia Pet. 503-963-4250. 503-963-4250.
Join us. This radio station is yours just as much as it is John's and as much as it is mine.
Radio is yours.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You can have an effect on the type of media that you hear, and you can have an effect on the type of stories and people you hear represented in that media. And that's what we're trying to do here on Five Quadrants and at X-Ray. Please consider becoming a member. 503-963-4250, xray.fm.
You want to do the legal ID?
Oh, sure. We're listening to KXRY Portland, 91.1 FM in the East City, and 107.1 FM citywide.
And you could go, we're worldwide.
Oh, my
Catch
goodness.
Us on xray.fm. You can become a member there. Jen Chavez, I will see you next week. It's always a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure, as always.
Nothing. We cannot talk today.
We're overcome by membership drive emotions.
We should just go get strangers from the street at this point and say, hey, can you please talk for us?